This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with actress Angelica Houston, who has a new memoir about the early part of her life called A Story Lately Told. Houston's best known for her performances in Pritzi's Honor, The Grifters, The Addams Family, The Royal Tenenbaums, and the TV series Smash. Houston's book ends before her successful acting career. That part of her life will be in Volume 2, now in the works. But her early years are worthy of a book. She's the daughter of John Houston, who directed nearly 50 films, including The Maltese Falcon, The African Queen, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and Pritzi's Honor, the film for which Angelica won an Oscar. Angelica's mother, Ricky, gave up a promising career as a ballet dancer when she married John Houston. He was 43, she was 18 and pregnant. 15 months after their son Tony arrived, Angelica was born. John Houston moved the family to Ireland, where Angelica grew up on an estate called St. Clarens.
Angelica Houston, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a short reading from your book. In fact, why don't you read the beginning of chapter one?
Thank you, Terry. I was born at 6:29 p.m. on July the 8th, 1951, at the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital in Los Angeles. At 8 pounds, 13 ounces, I was a big, healthy baby. The news of my arrival was cabled promptly to the post office in the township of Butaiba in western Uganda. 2 days later, a barefoot runner bearing a telegram finally arrived at Murchison Falls, a waterfall on the Nile, deep in the heart of the Belgian Congo, where the African Queen was being filmed. My father, John Marcellus Houston, was a director renowned for his adventurous style and audacious nature. Even though it was considered foolhardy, he'd persuaded not only Katharine Hepburn, an actress in her prime, but also Humphrey Bogart, who brought along his famously beautiful wife, the movie star Lauren Bacall, to share the hazardous journey. My mother, heavily pregnant, had stayed behind in Los Angeles with my one-year-old brother, Tony. When the messenger handed the telegram to my father, he glanced at it, then put it in his pocket. Katie Hepburn exclaimed, "For God's sakes, John, what does it say?" And Dad replied, "It's a girl. Her name is Angelica."
So, Angelica Houston, what's your reaction to that story of your birth? I mean, your father's making this classic film while you're born, which, you know, great for him, but he's not with your mother and he's not with you.
That's true. But he was often not with my mother and often not with me, which didn't alter in any way my profound love for him and my feelings, my daughterly feelings towards him. That was what he did. He was an adventurer and he lived in a grand style and everything around him and everything he did was a grand gesture. So this was sort of typical of who he was.
So your parents marry, your mother 18, your father in his 40s. Within about a year, she gives birth to your brother Tony, and then 15 months after that, she gives birth to you. Your father moves the family to Ireland. And reading this, I think your mother must have been so removed from her world. She's away from America. She's away from the people she knows. She's away from her work. She's not going to do ballet anymore. She's had two children. And after you were born, she goes into this postpartum depression. Do you think your mother resented that her life was so transformed in a way that that wasn't necessarily the direction she wanted to head in? Like, I don't know if, in retrospect, she really wanted to become a mother that young and to be leading the life that your father wanted her to have.
Yes, I think you have a good point there. I'm not sure whether or not she wanted to have my brother that soon, but that was what you did when you married. It wasn't really a conversation like it is these days. And I think, ideally, it must have seemed like a wonderful, sort of glamorous union with my father. But, of course, he was not a very faithful person. And I think that That must have been a big blow for her, knowing my mother as I did. She was romantic and naive in a way. And I think that must have been a big shock to her.
At some point, your father tells you and your older brother, Tony, to come visit him. And the big surprise is he's showing you that he has a new baby boy with, of course, a woman who's not your mother. By this time, I guess they're living separately. And you're right, you looked at this new baby and you thought, I hate him. And that baby, that baby's Danny Houston, who's turned out to be really a fine actor.
And the finest brother in the world.
Oh, really good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. What did it mean to you to see this baby born from, you know, born with another woman?
Well, the other woman wasn't just another woman. The other woman and I had made, we were very friendly. I'd made friends with her a couple of years before at St. Clarence, and I loved her. Her name was Zoe Salas, and my father called from Rome when he was making the Bible and told my mother that he wanted Tony, my brother, and I to go to Rome. And I remember saying to my mother, I don't want to go to Rome. And she said, why not? Is it because of Zoe? And I said, Zoe, why should that have to do with anything? Well, she didn't really reply. And Tony and I showed up in Rome and walked into the Grand Hotel. And my father clapped his hands together and said, sit down, kids. I have some great news. He said, you have a little brother. And I go, how is that possible? My mother wasn't pregnant. Anyway, then we were taken to see this baby who is in an apartment building somewhere on the other side of town. And lo and behold, Zoe was the baby's mother. So I was very shocked by that. And the baby was a toddler. He was crawling around on the floor on all fours, pretending to be a little dog. He was barking, and Dad was patting him on the head and telling him what a good little dog he was. And I sat there in sort of horrified silence for a while, and then came time to say goodbye to the little dog, and my brother kissed him, and Danny kissed him back, and then Dad said to me, kiss Danny goodbye. And I looked at this baby with sort of unconcealed hatred. And Danny held up his right hand, his little tiny, fat, pudgy toddler's hand, like a little claw, and growled at me. And I fell madly in love with him. He was just the cutest thing ever. And he had clocked me. He knew exactly what I was about.
Did you know before your mother did about this baby?
No. My mother knew. I hadn't said anything. And when I went back to London, my mother was pregnant. And
with another man?
No idea. With another man's baby, yes. That became my sister Allegra.
So your mother gives birth to Allegra. You fall in love with Allegra immediately. Let's talk a little bit about your mother. It sounds like your mother was very beautiful. And what did you understand about the importance of beauty when you were growing up? Your mother was beautiful. Your father directed beautiful actresses. So, I mean, beauty had tangible value.
Yes, it did. And yes, my mother was spectacularly beautiful. I think her awareness of beauty, my father's involvement with it, yeah, it was. It was definitely an asset. And not just people's physical beauty, but the physical beauty of things, of objects, too.
And you describe yourself as spending a lot of time looking at your face in the mirror. And you think it wasn't exactly vanity, it was something else. What were you looking for?
I was looking for the beauty. I was looking to see if it was there at all. And I think that really is a lot of what children look in the mirror. What that's about. It's not necessarily appreciating what you have. It's also looking for what you don't think you have.
And when you started to grow up, it sounds like your father was pretty uncomfortable. For example, he once accused you of doing the bumps. You didn't know what he meant, but you figured out he probably meant like dancing sensually with your hips. And you got really angry with him and said, "You don't love me." And then he hit you hard across the face. Reading that, it made me wonder, because he was so attracted to younger women, do you think he was especially scared that you were becoming sexual?
I think probably that had something to do with it. But I still think that he sort of wanted to stop time. And there I was, getting provocative and wearing short skirts and lots of makeup and dancing provocatively.
Maybe he was afraid also that you'd meet a man like he was, an older man who'd fall in love with younger women. And actually, that did happen a little later. Yeah,
that's exactly what happened.
We'll get to that a little later. So we were talking about how after your father had found out that you were doing this very sensual dancing and he slapped you, that you didn't want to be around him anymore. He scared you. But soon after that, he decided you should make your film debut in a movie he was directing, a film called A Walk with Love and Death, which I think few people remember. It didn't do well. You didn't want to do it. Why didn't you want to be in his film?
Well, for a start, he was very critical of me, and I wasn't comfortable with that. And it seemed to me that he didn't want me to be who I was. When he came up with this idea for A Walk with Love and Death, it was, I think, you know, with the best possible intent. He thought he was doing something very good for me. I told him that I wanted to be an actress. I'd made that abundantly clear to everyone. And so he contrived to make this happen. And I think to his way of thinking, it was a marvelous idea. To me, not so much. Plus which, Franco Zeffirelli had launched a school search for Juliet, for Romeo and Juliet. And I'd seen his producer a couple of times, and I'd been told that I would have a chance for a callback with Zeffirelli when he came to town. I was pretty excited about that. And then my father wrote Zeffirelli a letter telling him that I would be working with him. That upset me. And also, having read the script, I didn't feel that I'd be any good in this movie, really. It was the part of a 15th century maiden who falls in love with a student who's looking for the sea. It was a rather lyrical piece. I wouldn't have said that, you know, there was much to sink one's teeth into. And the character was, I felt, a bit wet, you know? And I don't think my father was particularly interested in hearing my criticisms on this script. I was a 16-year-old girl who'd never acted before, really. Who was I to have these reservations? He was a great director, you know, and I think he thought I was a pipsqueak, and I probably was.
There's a paragraph about this that I'd like you to read. It's on page 170.
I would have much preferred to work with Zeffirelli. The prospect of making a movie with Dad, his directing me, surrounded by his regular crew, most of whom had known me since babyhood, would diminish my power to self-invent on my own terms. It was as important for me to present a new persona off-camera as it was to play an original character on film.
I have to say, I really related to that. My background is, like, not at all like yours. My father certainly didn't direct me in movies. But I shared that sense that to be yourself, to find out who you are, you have to do that process away from your parents, because to you, they're your daughter, and they know who their daughter is. But there's a part of you that's totally independent of being the daughter. And that's somebody who is being created independent of that, or largely independent of that. And so I feel like I really understood how difficult it would be for you to express yourself as an artist in this role with your father insisting that he knew who you really were and that you couldn't be yourself or couldn't be your interpretation of the actress, of the character.
Exactly. And also, by the mere fact of all of these people who were his regular crew members, they also remembered me as John's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So that would create a barrier for me to in order to express myself as somebody else or something else.
So did that make you want to give up on acting?
No, it didn't. It made me want to act for somebody else.
But what you actually did was go into modeling instead.
Well, I did that because I didn't know that I'd be getting a lot of offers pursuant to some very, shall we say, raw criticisms and reviews. So having been invited by Dick Avedon to go to Ireland for a nice layout for Vogue and also being invited by other magazines to model for them, it was a sort of it was a good way to approach what I wanted to do again without the kind of criticism inherent in making movies.
You write that you felt powerful in front of the camera modeling, but you hadn't felt powerful in front of the camera acting. Now, that's in part because your father was directing and you didn't like the role and you didn't like the dialogue. But what was it that made you feel powerful in front of the camera when you were modeling? Because also you didn't think you were beautiful.
Well, no, but I could be convinced. and that was one of, you know, certainly Dick Avedon's major assets was the fact that he could certainly make you feel that way. I think it was his sort of métier to make women bloom in front of his camera with music and lighting and beautiful clothes and Dick Avedon telling you you look good. That was pretty nice.
Wasn't it Avedon who had earlier told your mother that you'd never be a model because your shoulders were too wide?
Yes, he told that to my mother, and I was like, oh God, nose too big, maybe, but now shoulders too wide.
I bet you'd never thought about there were a lot of your problems. Shoulders before.
never occurred to me.
So one of the photographers who photographed you was Bob Richardson, and you and he became lovers for about 4 years. You had just turned 18 when you started your relationship. He was 42. That so much reminded me of your parents, when your mother was 18 and your father was in his 40s. Did you think about that when you started the relationship, that you were age-wise duplicating what they'd had?
I don't think it was the first thing to occur to me. It was kind of, I guess, I thought it was a bit of a coincidence, but I don't remember spending a lot of time thinking, oh, wow, this is a repeat performance.
And in retrospect?
I think I was looking for a parent who approved.
Oh, as opposed to your father who didn't?
Yeah. And my mother who was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was largely my attraction to Bob. And also, he was very seductive. And I loved working for him. I always loved working for his camera. He was incredibly intuitive, very sensitive. He seemed to understand everything. He seemed to know me.
You're right, he was also controlling and sometimes abusive. And you're right, I had mistaken Bob's need for dominance and control as love.
Well, yes, and he was also schizophrenic, which is...
Which you didn't know at the time.
No, I had no idea. I had no idea, and I didn't even really know what schizophrenia was. I didn't know that there were moments where he was completely out of control, but I was to learn that.
And you also didn't know he'd been diagnosed as bipolar, and he was also bisexual.
Right, which I never knew.
How did you find that out?
Much later, I read it. I read it in an article about Bob that was published in The New Yorker in the, I think, late 80s. I had no idea. I was fairly innocent.
What made you realize you needed to leave? Like for your own, you know, mental health, you needed to leave?
Well, we had an episode at the Chelsea Hotel one day after about 4 days of his turning his face to the wall. And I went into the bathroom and pulled a razor blade across my wrist. And it occurred to me that if I stayed with him, I'd die at some point, that I wouldn't survive him, that you know, being with somebody like that could push me over the edge.
So when you left, where did you go to? What was the next step?
The next step was California, and my father had come to visit us. Finally, after several years, he and Bob finally met. And he invited us to go on a fishing trip in Cabo San Lucas. And it was absolutely horrible. My father had just gotten married again, and we went out on this little boat in the middle of the Sea of Cortez. And it was a long, hot day, and I got a terrible suntan, and we came back to... Finally, oh, yeah, the boat caught fire at one point. We had to be rescued, and we got back to the hotel, and we sort of went over to the bar, and Dad said, "What would you like to drink, honey," to me? And I said, "Oh, I'd like a strawberry daiquiri." And Bob said, "No, you want a banana daiquiri." I was caught between these two guys. I thought, oh, dear, this is hellish. Anyway, the trip progressed in the most awful way. And ultimately, Bob and I parted at LAX. He held out his hand to shake mine. And I refused it. And that was it.
We're going to have to wait till Volume 2 to find out more about your acting career. But I just think it's so great that your father, who kind of scared you away from acting, because it was such a really bad experience and you got such bad reviews, you know, he also kind of, you know, directs you in the film that really made you famous, Pritzi's Honor. You won an Oscar for that. He won an Oscar for that.
He didn't, actually.
The film that did. Was it the film that did?
No, the film didn't. Out of Africa won that year.
Oh.
Yeah, no, I was the only one to win an Oscar and felt a bit lonely about it, but oh well.
Oh yes, worse things have happened.
Yes, they have.
Terry Gross speaking with Angelica Houston. You can read the introduction to Houston's new memoir, A Story Lately Told, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Director Alexander Payne's sixth feature film, Nebraska, is a comedy set in his home state. Bruce Dern stars in the film as an old man convinced he's won a magazine sweepstakes. Former Saturday Night Live cast member Will Forte plays Dern's son, who reluctantly agrees to drive his dad the long distance to collect the prize. Film critic David Edelstein went along for the ride.
Last month, I saw the trailer for Alexander Payne's Nebraska, and only the fact it was a Payne film made me want to see it. The premise seemed a dead end. Bruce Dern plays an elderly man named Woody Grant, living in Billings, Montana, who gets a letter saying he's won $1 million, and all he needs to do is call a number and maybe buy a magazine subscription. Instead of laughing it off, Woody insists on traveling hundreds of miles to company headquarters in Lincoln, Nebraska, for his fortune, walking if need be. I doubt Payne had much to do with that trailer, but it's awful. Do you want to see another whimsical tale of a puckish elder doing the darndest things while yokels cheer him on? I admit my prejudice because, in the end, Nebraska is a special kind of triumph, a movie I argued with constantly, but won me over. It was hard to make an emotional investment in Woody, who's not just wrong about the prize, but ornery, alcoholic, and according to his belligerent wife, played by June Squibb, a lousy husband and worse dad. Watching it, though, I gave Woody the benefit of the doubt because of Dern, an actor who never quite found a niche, but hung on honorably, and incidentally gave us a treasure in his daughter, Laura. Dern always had a runner's gauntness, but as Woody, he's painfully thin, with a shock of white hair and eyes that are mostly cast down. When he lifts them, though, they're huge and liquid. It's a beautiful, near-pantomime performance. Nebraska is a road movie, and since Woody lost his driver's license and his family won't let him walk, it all comes down to his son, David, played by Will Forte, an electronics salesman whose longtime girlfriend just decamped. David finds Woody trudging through the snow, bound yet again for Nebraska.
Dad. Dad.
Leave me alone.
Come on. Let me take you home.
I'm going to Lincoln. It's the last thing I do. And I don't care what you people think.
Listen to me. You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam. So you got to stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
You didn't even have a suitcase.
I'm not staying there.
Dad, I can't let you go.
It's none of your business.
Yes, it is. I'm your son.
Well, then why don't you take me?
You can't just drop everything and drive to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, what else you got going on?
Will Forte is an ordinary-looking guy with a manic streak that in comedy takes him strange and exhilarating places. He doesn't tap that mania in Nebraska. He's the harried straight man. But his energy keeps the movie bouncing along. David reacts to everything, while his father appears to register nothing. Appears to. Alcohol, as well as age, has burned out many synapses, and Woody never was given to talk. The question hangs, how much does the old man see and feel? The movie's true destination turns out not to be Lincoln, but a stopover, the small Nebraska town where Woody once made his life. His extended family is there, and so are many old neighbors and friends. Uneasy friends, like the ex-business partner, played by a hard, scary Stacy Keach, who says Woody owes him money, and now that he's a millionaire, hand it over. There's a tension between the crabbed characters and the expansive, wide frames, heavy on farmland iconography and cows and puffy clouds, shot by Fade and Papa Michael in crisp and gorgeous black and white. In one scene, Woody joins his elderly brothers for a reunion. The old men sit in plaid shirts before a TV, trading monosyllables without looking one another's way. It's an easy sight gag, but they're fine, weathered features turn it into something mysterious and iconic. Nebraska is a superb balancing act. The whimsy is always cut by settings redolent of alcohol and rust and old man bars. But it's never too grim, as Woody's hellion wife, the diminutive June Squibb, blasts out her put-downs and brings down the house along with her targets. Bob Odenkirk pairs perfectly with Forte as Woody's more successful son, a TV reporter. And in the end, Payne and screenwriter Bob Nelson pull a rabbit out of their hat. The real journey hasn't been to a silly sweepstakes company. They turn the focus inward. They go to the emotional heart of Woody's absurd, quixotic quest. Maybe there's no cash at Road's End, but we feel like $1 million.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed the new film Nebraska. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If your Thanksgiving turkey didn't turn out quite the way you'd hoped, listening closely to this next interview might help you with a trick or two before cooking your next big holiday meal. We're going to hear Terry talk about holiday cooking with Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of the public TV series America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. They have some suggestions for preparing turkey and great winter holiday side dishes. Lancaster and Bishop are editors of the new America's Test Kitchen Cooking School cookbook. Bishop is also the editorial director of America's Test Kitchen. Lancaster is the executive food editor for New Media Television and Radio.
Bridget Lancaster, Jack Bishop, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is always fun to have you on the show. So, since we're in holiday season, let's start with turkey. If you can each give us one tip that you think is really helpful in preparing turkey. Bridget, you want to get started?
Sure. I think one of the biggest tips that we can offer is don't buy too big of a bird. 12 to 14 pounds is kind of the limit. Any larger than that, and you're going to have a really big problem cooking it evenly, because we always know that the breast meat tends to cook a lot faster than the dark meat. And it's also a problem of mechanics. It's really hard to get a 20-pound turkey into some of the more modern ovens. So I'd say that starting with a medium-sized turkey is a great way to start Thanksgiving. And then after that, it's just really making sure that you season the turkey. We like natural turkeys, ones that aren't pre-brined or injected. So you either want to brine it, soak the turkey in a salt water solution, or you can rub salt under the skin, and that really, along with thyme, helps to season the meat very well.
And is that the spice time or the ticking clock time that you're talking
about? Ah, that's the ticking clock time. Okay. Very good catch. Yeah, you do want to let either the brine or the salt rub do its job. Salting takes a bit more time, clock time. 24 hours is a good period of time to wait. And that allows the salt to – it pulls out the moisture from the meat, which sounds like a bad thing, but then it mingles back with the salt, goes back into the meat. It slowly seasons it. And also the breast meat is great when it's salted because it tends to hang on its moisture a little bit more. So it gives you a bit of a window or a cushion, error cushion there, so you don't overcook it and end up with turkey that's like from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Jack, do you have a turkey tip for us?
Yeah, and it comes at the end of the process. I generally make Thanksgiving, but when I'm at other people's homes, I see the rush to carve.
Yes.
And turkey needs to rest before you carve it. If you're using a small bird like Bridget suggests, and I totally agree, a 12 or 14-pound bird is best, it's maybe 30 minutes. If you've got a larger bird, maybe 40 minutes. And two things that you're doing. One is it's much simpler to carve a bird that's not scorching hot. Second thing is you're letting the muscle fibers relax so that they can hold on to more of those juices and that a lot fewer juices will end up on the carving board. Last thing, the benefit is it gives you a little bit more time to get all those last minute side dishes, especially anything that has to go into the oven, done. So take the turkey out, get it out of the pan, put it on the carving board. If you want to loosely tent it with foil and walk away for 30 minutes. You've got plenty to do. Have a last drink before dinner if you've got nothing else to do, and then come back and carve it.
In your new America's Test Kitchen Cooking School cookbook, you recommend crisping the skin. What's the best way to crisp it?
Well, there's a couple of ways. One way is we rub the skin with a mixture of salt and pepper and a little bit of baking powder. And the baking powder, it seems very odd, but it actually is starting to dry out the surface just a little bit. It's not going to taste like a cookie or anything like that, so you don't have to worry about the baking powder tasting off. But that and loosening the skin, getting some of the season under the skin, and then you can finish it off at a pretty high temperature just to give it a nice final blast of heat. That will give it really nice crisp skin.
Jack, I know you don't eat as much meat as Bridget does. So,
Nobody does.
Do you ever do an alternative to turkey for Thanksgiving or for Christmas? And do you want to recommend a nice alternative holiday dish?
I do think Christmas, you have a little bit more leeway. Thanksgiving without turkey, it's a tough sell when it's a large crowd. But when I do have more leeway, one of the things I love to do is make a whole side of salmon. Everybody pretty much eats fish, and it's sort of in between, you know, it's not a vegetarian holiday meal, which is hard for a large crowd, but there are a lot of vegetarians who do eat fish, and so they're happy. And I love to do this great recipe, oven poaching. You know, when I first started cooking, I got one of these beautiful French poachers. They're about 2 feet long. At the time, I think it cost $100, and this was many, many, many years ago. And you fill it with water and you poach on top of the stove. Our method is to use aluminum foil and to put the whole side of salmon on several layers of foil, layer on some fresh herbs, I think dill is best, and sliced lemon, and then wrap up the foil and poach it directly on the oven rack in a hot oven. And by being on the oven rack, you get heat from underneath and on top, and you get perfectly cooked salmon. There's no water involved, so it's actually poaching in its natural juices and has a much better flavor, I think, than the traditional salmon that you poach in wine and water and lemon and herbs. Is to just, you know, get rid of the wine and the water and just let the lemon and herbs flavor the fish.
Sounds good. Do you serve it hot or cold?
I serve it hot. I have a really fun recipe that we developed in the test kitchen that seems very luxurious to go with it, where it's a horseradish cream sauce, but you whip the cream as if you were making whipped cream for a pie. You just don't leave out the sugar. And then you add horseradish and a little salt and pepper. And a dollop of that is a really great accompaniment to the salmon and, you know, says sort of festive to me.
That sounds really good. So getting back to a more traditional holiday dish, what's your favorite kind of stuffing?
I'm a cornbread stuffing man. That is my favorite. I feel like it's worth the effort to make some homemade cornbread, dry it out. I usually do a fruit and nut stuffing with dried apricots, dried prunes, toasted pecans, I will saute celery and onion in some butter, fresh sage, fresh thyme, some parsley. That's the best stuffing in the world.
And you put it in as you're putting the bird in?
I think one more idea about making it easier to cook the turkey is to not stuff it and instead put the stuffing in a dish, which then it becomes dressing, if you want to be technical about it. And, you know, the problem is when you stuff the turkey, yes, the stuffing gets all the wonderful flavors from the bird, but it makes it much more difficult to cook the bird, cooks a lot more slowly and unevenly. And obviously, if you've got vegetarians, then they're not going to eat the stuffing. So I always just do it in buttered big dishes and cover it with foil for most of the cooking, usually about 30, 40 minutes until it's warm, and then take off the foil so that the top can crisp up. And it's absolutely delicious.
Stupid question. Why does the stuffing affect the cooking of the turkey?
So you're changing the sort of thermodynamics of what's going on inside the bird. And generally, the stuffing is cold in traditional recipes. And so the temperature of that stuffing brings down everything and just makes it that much slower to heat up. And the disparity between the white meat and the dark meat, it mostly affects the white meat, not the dark meat. And of course, the white meat is the thing that's likely to overcook. So you keep the bird in longer trying to get the stuffing up to a safe temperature because the stuffing has eggs in it generally, and that's the last thing to warm up because it's in the dead center of the turkey. And you're waiting and waiting and waiting until the stuffing's at a safe temperature. Meanwhile, the breast meat is so overcooked that there's really nothing you can do. If you want to stuff your bird, you should actually microwave the stuffing before you put it in.
I thought I heard you say microwave.
Hey!
I know, your favorite cooking tool, but you microwave the stuffing and then you put hot stuffing inside the turkey, which it's a bit of a chore, frankly. But that's the best way if you are actually going to cook a stuffed bird is to begin with fairly hot stuffing. You want to get it to about 120, 130 degrees, and so that you don't have quite that problem with ice-cold stuffing slowing down the whole process.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of America's Test Kitchen. They've edited a new cookbook called America's Test Kitchen Cooking School Cookbook. Favorite holiday side dishes?
I am a sweet potato addict.
Oh, good. Yes. Keep going.
A few years ago, I think I pretty much banned regular mashed potatoes and said only sweet potatoes from now on. So I do a mashed sweet potato. So mashed sweet potatoes are so incredibly easy to make as long as you remember that you can't cook them like regular potatoes. They contain a lot more water. Sweet potatoes do. So if you boil them in lots of liquid, you end up with sweet potatoes that have fallen apart. They're very soggy. So we actually braise sweet potatoes. You slice sweet potatoes very thin, about a quarter inch. and you put them in a saucepan, or you can double the recipe, put it in a Dutch oven, and a little bit of just a few tablespoons of heavy cream, a couple of pats of butter, and you cook it over low for a good 35 minutes or so until the potatoes are very, very tender. And pretty much all the liquid has been either been absorbed by the potatoes or evaporated at that point. And you just simply mash them, season them with a little salt and pepper, and finish it up. And it's so simple. We make this all the time in my house, but it's definitely a Thanksgiving must.
So I assume you peel the sweet potato before?
You sure do. You peel the sweet potatoes. You want to cut them in half lengthwise so you get a nice flat surface. You can also, if sweet potatoes are huge, and it seems to be that there's, you know, there are some sort of giant sweet potato farms out there these days, you can quarter it lengthwise. So you're working now with much smaller pieces, easier to handle. And as long as you cook them until they're the right texture, it's more about the visual cue than the timing. You know, a knife slips into the slices very easily. And you just mash them with a potato masher. You're not going to have any of that stringy sweet potato fibrous texture. They're like butter, and they're great. You can fold in some smoked cheese, or you can fold in top it with a little bit of toasted nuts if you want. Pretty much anything that you want to do to dress them up.
So, if you could suggest a good vegetable side dish, Jack, why don't you go first? Because I know you love vegetables.
Yeah, and I feel like the best way to cook almost any vegetable is to roast it in a hot oven. And so I love to have something green on the table. I think it's an absolute must, and love the idea of roasting broccoli. And it's very, very simple. You want to cut the broccoli and separate the florets from the stalks. I then peel the stalks with a vegetable peeler. A lot of people throw them out, and I think they're actually the best part. If you peel that outer skin, they cook up super creamy and tender. And so once the skin is removed from the stalks, I then cut them into planks, maybe 2 or 3 inches long and about a half inch wide. I then will take the florets and leave them in pretty big pieces. A regular head of broccoli, I might cut into 4 or 6 pieces, those florets. Toss that with some olive oil, salt, and pepper in a bowl. Add just a sprinkling of sugar, half a teaspoon of sugar for a head of broccoli, because that's really going to encourage the browning. And then throw them onto a hot sheet pan that's been heated in the oven. So you put the sheet pan in the oven, turn the oven on to 500, and it's basically like stir frying in your oven on a sheet pan. You throw the broccoli on. 10 minutes later, it is gorgeous. It's browned, charred in little spots, really, really tasty. Frankly, I think a drizzle of olive oil and you're done. If you want to dress it up, you can put some shaved Parmesan. You could add some spices. You could saute some shallots or fennel and add that as well. But honestly, just the good olive oil and the broccoli and you're done.
Bridget, you have a vegetable dish for us?
I do. I grew up eating greens, a big pot of simmering greens, collards, sometimes kale, which is very hip these days, turnip greens, all these different kinds of greens. And I still like to serve greens during the holidays, but they get a pretty bad rap when they're cooked improperly. They're slimy, full of all this liquid. They don't taste like a lot because you have this pot full of liquid and you pour off the pot and all the flavor goes with it. So instead, we cook them in very little liquid. You have your big Dutch oven. You can add some of the greens, which are roughly chopped. We like to use collards and kale for in this particular recipe because they're heartier greens. And you add half the greens at first, and they start to wilt in this pot that's got some nice browned red onion, a little bit of garlic, red pepper flakes. You add the rest of the greens, and you do that in 2 batches so that they start to wilt a little bit and you have room for the entire greens in one pot. And then after they've cooked for just a few moments, you add some chicken broth, a little bit of water, and you simmer it covered until the greens are nice and tender. And that takes about a half an hour, depending on if it's kale or collards. After that, you remove the lid and you crank the heat up and let some of that liquid evaporate. So you've got the essence of the greens still in that liquid. You've got the chicken broth. You've got the garlic, the onion, and it all concentrates and starts to coat the greens. Even my kids will eat this, I have to say. And, of course, greens can always use a little bit of brightness right before you serve them because they can taste a little bit cooked. So some cider vinegar, and I start the recipe by – I should have mentioned this because this makes everything better. I start the recipe by crisping some bacon.
I knew you were going to say that.
So – well, bacon and greens.
You're always like, talking about putting bacon in. Bacon and mushrooms.
You start with a little bit of bacon. You cook the onions in the rendered bacon fat, and then you crumble that bacon – well, what's left of it if I haven't eaten it all – and just crumble it right over the finished greens right before you serve it. And it is – between the little hit of vinegar, the spices, the browned onions, and the nice silky and tender greens, it's a really, really good side dish.
Terry, I have to tell you a little story about Bridget. There are a lot of people in the food business that are very passionate about pork and pigs, and I see a lot of people now getting pig tattoos. Bridget, though, has this beautiful little gold necklace dangling from her neck of a little pig that I think she wears it every day. I don't remember seeing you not wearing your little friend.
My little Arnold.
So one last question about the holidays. In your family, did people like eat and overeat and overeat some more and then complain for the rest of the night because they'd overeaten?
Oh, I think my sharpest holiday memory is being on the couch with my belt unbuckled with my brother and my sister, sort of saying, why?
Bridget?
Yeah, my grandfather would have, quote-unquote, dinner on the table at noon. And it actually was the best idea because you have this great meal. We would go outside. We would play football. You'd burn it off, of course, after a good nap. And then around 4 or 5 o'clock, you went in for the best part, which is the leftovers. Definitely recommend eating as early as possible.
Did you have breakfast first?
Did have breakfast, but that was usually life cereal.
Okay. Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop are editors of the new America's Test Kitchen Cooking School Cookbook. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry, as well as some of their turkey tips and recipes online at freshair.npr.org.